Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Let's start today's episode off with a question, a favorite topic of conversation for those of us here at How Stuff Works when we're just hanging out off the air. Have you ever wanted to perpetrate a heist like Ocean's 11 style? And if so, did you ever envision yourself having a specialty? You know how all the heist teams always have their specialists, right?
Well, I've always wanted to be the bag man.
The bag man.
I want to be the bag man.
Yeah, yeah.
What does that entail? It's the coolest title.
Yeah, it's up there. The bag man generally, and someone write in and correct us if I'm off base here, but the bag man generally is a term describing the person who actually, when you're physically stealing currency or jewelry or precious metals, the person who physically holds the bag.
You see, I'm known for my grip.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, they say, Noel Brown, that kid's got a good grip.
They usually refer to me, Ben Bolin, in my past heist, as either the inside man or the shady government liaison.
I would have called you the brain.
That's very kind. That's very kind. And I guess by virtue of his position on the show, our super producer, Casey Pegram, would probably be, and I don't want to pigeonhole you here, Casey, our computer expert. You got to have a hacker.
Yeah. You know, it's actually funny. There was a character in one of the Grand Theft Auto games that reminded me a lot of Casey. And Casey, if you take this as an insult and you know the character I'm talking about, please don't, because I'm more talking about his very intelligent demeanor, not his look. He was a little bit of an odd-looking fellow. But he's the guy that ran the warehouse where they planned all the heists, and they had the big chalkboard, and they, you know, drew the maps, and they had the big table. Remember that guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As long as you're not Trevor Phillips, Casey.
Grove Street forever, man.
Oh, man. Is he the like, the meth head guy?
Yeah.
Trevor.
Trevor Phillips is the unhinged meth head guy.
Yeah, he lived kind of out in the Salton Sea type area what's the name of the fake L.A.? San Andreas?
Yeah, well, I want to say. There's definitely a San Andreas. It's got to be San Andreas.
I have a segue. It's actually going to work here, Ben.
All right, go for it.
We're talking about video games. Mm-hmm. You ever heard of the Assassin's Creed video games?
Yes, I've played them all, actually.
Is this one out yet? I just saw this video. It's called, like, Assassin's Creed something, Legacy or something, but it's about
Origins?
Or maybe it's about London gangs.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if that one's out yet.
Okay. Then I saw a preview of this game, and it's about London gangs. Mm-hmm. And in this game, the topic of today's episode was paid homage to.
Oh, wonderful. They talked about the 40 Thieves?
The Farty Thieves.
The Farty Elephant Gang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember the gangs of New York? Wasn't there a gang called the Farty Thieves?
An Irish gang?
An Irish gang, yeah.
Yeah, and just to be clear, we're saying 4-0 with an Irish accent, not the flatulent elephants or the flatulent thieves. Yeah, that's awesome. I want to check that game out. I mean, have you played Assassin's Creed before?
I have not.
Oh, it's funny. It can be repetitive at times. It's a mixture of some really cool fighting and then some, at times, incredibly frustrating jump around, solve the puzzle sequences.
Isn't there a lot of, like, stalk, kind of like from a distance, keep your distance, and then move in for the kill kind of stuff?
But, I mean, who hasn't done that?
Totally.
Just in regular life.
Oh, yeah.
So there was a real-life gang of thieves, jewel thieves specifically, that were known for their successful, very well-planned-out heist. They were active for more than 200 years.
See, I thought that was a typo when I first saw it.
I did
surely
as well.
Someone added an extra zero.
Right. No, 200 years. And this gang was made entirely of female criminals operating out of the Elephant and Castle area of London.
Which I find to be a magnificently whimsical name for an area.
London and, you know, the UK in general, they have wonderful names for places and streets and neighborhoods. But I got to say, I'm not a fan of British names for food, probably just because I didn't grow up there, but like barley water, spotted dick.
Bubble and squeak.
Bubble and squeak isn't even that egregious.
It sounds like fun, whatever it is.
But barley water, that sounds like a punishment.
That's beer, right?
I don't think it is, Noel.
Really?
I think it's... It sounds like it would be a good euphemism for beer, but barley water is it's just boiled grain in water that hasn't, you know, it still doesn't have alcohol.
Well, it seems like if there's no alcohol, why would you bother?
Right. Why would you bother consuming barley? So when did the 40 Thieves really, what were their glory days, Noel?
Well, we talked about that they were also called the 40 Elephants.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's what I'm going to refer to them as, because they lived in this elephant and castle district. They were also, they were self-contained, and they were an all-female band of heisters. I don't know what you want to call it, criminals. But they were backed up by another gang of kind of really rough and tumble dudes who were the Elephant and Castle Gang, who kind of like were almost like their muscle. But yeah, so they were active possibly as early as the 1700s. Based on police records, and a lot of this comes from a book called The Gangs of London by a guy named Brian McDonald. And he says that the 40 Elephant Gang was probably the most active between the 1870s and the 1950s. But again, go back as far as possibly the 1700s.
Right. It may have been operating without being recognized. Brian McDonald also has a book specifically about the 40 Elephants and one of their most notable leaders, who we'll get to in a moment. But the book is called Alice Diamond and the 40 Elephants. I appreciate that you mentioned the Elephant and Castle Mob. They were, in a way, the muscle. They were headed by these guys called the McDonald brothers. And while they were allied together, they differed widely in their methods. So the Elephant Castle Mob, they were more kind of bruisers, but the 40 Thieves or the 40 Elephants were much more calculated in their crime. They would play the long game. At times, they would masquerade as housemaids for wealthy families, or they would use false references and back up the references as well. And during the early 20th century, they were led by someone called Alice Diamond, known variously as the Queen of the 40 Thieves or as Diamond Annie.
That's the thing, Ben. They were a very, very militaristically run organization from their inception. They operated in a series of like cells, almost like a terrorist group. And they always were led by a queen. This Annie Diamond was just kind of the most notorious and influential one.
Yeah, that's correct. There were many, because again, this gang was active for around 200 years, far surpassing the lifespan of the average person at the time. And in their heyday, it's strange because they were romanticized a bit by papers of the time. In one paper, they were referred to as Amazons, who were handsome women about 6 feet tall. We can walk through maybe some of their methods, because I know we made them sound like they only did disguise work, but that was just one of their many strategies for bilking people out of jewelry and valuables. They did a shoplifting method that is actually still common and in practice in parts of the world today, which is overpowering a store through the sheer volume of people participating. All of the gang members would rush into a store from various entrances, and then since there were too many people to apprehend, they would just grab everything they can, and then they would flee out of the store heading in multiple directions, knowing that not all of them could be caught.
Not only that, they had like reserve funds for when they had to bail out the one or two stragglers that did get caught. Mm-hmm. And they basically were considered like untouchable because they had deals running with the police. And this is a very corrupt period in English history. You have to remember this is like on the tail end of the Industrial Revolution. Things were changing really, really quickly. And it was kind of like just a free-for-all as far as these street gangs, of which there were many. And I just wanted to rattle off a few other ones. And there, you know, in this part of the country, is huge. You've got gangs like the Scuttlers, the High Rip Gang, the Peaky Blinders in Birmingham. You've got the Cock Road Gang and other such amazingly absurd and beautiful names. But the 40 Elephants had an incredible reputation for being ruthless and being cunning and being, like I said before, practically untouchable because of the way they ran their operation in these cells. And like you're saying, Ben, the way they were able to kind of scatter, you know?
Yeah, kind of a Hydra organization. Cut off one head and two will rise in its place. I don't think we mentioned that Diamond Annie was ruling during the interwar period. So she's around 1910 or the late 1910s. So World War One has already started, she and her lieutenant, Baby-Faced Maggie, which I love these nicknames. Amazing. Everybody's got a great nickname. They're the ones who reputedly had the idea of partnering with the Elephant and Castle mob to make sure that they had enforcers. There's an excellent article about this gang written by Amelia Hill for The Guardian called Girl Gang's Grip on London, Underworld Revealed. And it dives into some of the work of Brian McDonald, but it also gives us a good context for the time in which this gang existed, or this glory day era, because they were taking advantage of the misogynistic, chauvinistic attitudes of the time. You know, people thought, oh, a woman couldn't possibly be a criminal if she's dressed well.
Yeah, and I heard this somewhere, Ben, and let me know if you did or if you think this is completely bogus, but I heard that they sort of had an advantage because women weren't allowed to do very much on their own in this time. But one thing they were allowed to do was shop.
Right.
On their own. Mm-hmm. And it may have even been that they were not paid as close attention to because of the fact, like you're saying, that they're wearing nice clothes and that they're on their own unaccompanied without a chaperone.
You want to respect their privacy. You don't want to be forward in this very repressed age. So there were some upsides here, which we can explore later, but there are some other organizational things that they were very talented at. They had their own territory, like most gangs do, but they demanded a percentage of all crimes committed in their territory. So if there's another gang, we'll make up a gang. Let's say the Devon Rye on Sandwich gang steals something. It doesn't matter what they steal.
They get wind of it.
They steal hats, yeah. And then the 40 thieves or the 40 elephants find out about it. They will demand a percentage from that haberdasher's robbery because it happened on their turf. And then if someone refused to pay up, got a bit too big for their britches or perhaps their trousers, then the gang would send their Elephant and Castle mob.
That's right.
To beat the snot out of them or kidnap their notable members or their family members until their percentage was paid.
And that's not to say that the female members of this gang weren't bruisers in and of themselves. Diamond Annie, for example, got her name because she had a fistful of diamond rings that if she clocked you in the face with, you'd probably lose an eye or, you know, you would not be doing very well. And they were known for wriggling out of tight situations with the law with violent methods. They'd carry blackjacks and straight razors and all kinds of concealed weapons. But for the big stuff, like you said, the door-to-door, you know, give us our, what do you call it, like our VIG or whatever, you know, or like the, what do they call it in The Sopranos when they get in collections, right, going door-to-door. They left that to the big burly dudes.
Yeah. There might also be the matter of protection fees or something like that.
There you go.
Common mob
tactic.
Yeah,
exactly.
They also did something that may surprise people. They diversified their crime, which makes it more mafioso and less just street gang. They were very into blackmailing men, seducing married men or men of note, and then forcing them to pay either a huge lump sum or a continuing, almost a service fee, not to reveal their carnal predilections.
Yeah. And we're kind of leaning on some of the most well-known members of this gang, like Diamond Annie in particular. Like you said, I mean, that book that McDonald wrote focuses a lot on her. But there's a lot of periods in this gang's history that we don't know a whole lot about other than that they did exist.
Right, because they were also successful at functioning away from the spotlight. It's weird because for almost 200 years, you know, they were playing a very dangerous game. If any of them were caught, they could be sentenced to somewhere between 3 and 12 months hard labor or 3 years in prison. And hard labor at the time, we've talked about this in previous episodes, was absolutely no joke. You know, you're like you're unraveling rope. I think that's one of the things you had to do. You're digging ditches. And despite these high risk and these serious consequences, a lot of the gang members, maybe even the majority, were long timers. Maggie Hughes, or Babyface Maggie, had shoplifting convictions that went back to the age of 14. And when these, as I think we said earlier, when these women or members of the gang were caught, they did have their own independent support system. So your family members or your, you know, your dependents would be taken care of, or they would help you fight the system, get out of jail. But another, I like that you mentioned the fact that there were many other people who were lost to history that were members of this gang. We know a few. There's, for example, Ada Wellman, who was convicted of shoplifting from Army and Navy stores in Victoria in 1921. And she was, we know she was still an active member of the gang almost 20 years later, because she shows up in police reports 18 years after her 1921 arrest, when she got jailed for 4 months due to another crime. So these are career criminals. It's not like a side job. It doesn't sound like they were doing that thing so common in heist movies where we say, you know, Casey, Noel, let's get the gang back together for one last score.
No, this is a perma score. This is a life. I mean, this is a generational thing. If we're talking about 200 years of this, I'm going to call it an organization, because that's clearly what it was, and it was maintained that way for quite a long time. You know, this stuff, these tricks of the trade would be passed down, you know? Like, I mean, it's really fascinating.
So they had one, I guess, great problem that any shoplifting network will run into if they are successful. And the problem was, they had abundance of stolen riches. How do they get rid of this? How do they take something that they have stolen, for instance, a unique piece of jewelry, right, or very high-quality clothing, and translate that into cold, hard cash? This meant they had to create a distribution network so that they would, you know, because if they stole something and then just waited a week and started wearing those clothes or selling diamonds on the street, boom, they're back to hard labor again. So they instead relied on a network of fences and then unaffiliated street market traders and, of course, pawn shops. So part of the clothing they stole would be just sold to a clothing store, and the clothing store, just to make some scratch, all they would do is replace the labels. So you would say, oh, that's not a Hertfordshire Blackfoot bustier. Mm-hmm. I'm just making stuff up here.
You were close, though. I think one of the big stores they robbed had a very similar name to that.
And just like the gang itself, this network, while being fluid, also prospered for a long time. The 40 Thieves seem to have been at their glory days in the 1920s and 1930s. So that's why we know so much about Alice Diamond, or Diamond Annie, the woman with the punch to beware of. Oh, I guess we could talk a little bit about her background if you want, just briefly.
Oh, we absolutely should, Ben, but I do just want to point out the names of some of the biggest retail stores in London on the high street that they hit. It was, because you made up a beautiful one, and it made me think of, it wasn't that far off, Ben. We've got Debenham and Freebody.
Oh, what do they sell?
You know, ladies' lingerie. It's more of a department store. They sell it all. you know, it's just sort of like a Sears type situation, I imagine.
Yeah, like a department store.
A department store, yeah.
Kind of a Harrods.
Exactly.
Okay. So since we are lucky enough to know a little bit about the notorious Alice Diamond, let's look into her background. She was born in 1896, June of 1896, in Lambeth Workhouse Hospital. And Diamond was her real name. It wasn't just a cool moniker. Her father was named Thomas Diamond. Her parents had applied for a maternity berth under the name of Black before they married, because at the time, Alice would have been an illegitimate child because she had been born out of wedlock. However, since they decided instead to marry shortly before Alice was born to avoid the problem, her father had at least 3 criminal convictions, including one where he assaulted the son of the Lord Mayor of London by punching his head through a pane of glass in a door. And Alice turned out to be the eldest of 7 children. One of her younger sisters also joined the 40 Thieves gang. And one of her brothers, Tommy, became a member of the Elephant and Castle gang.
Ben, can I just point out really quick that, that I have seen it as Alice and also Annie.
Yes, yeah,
just
good call.
Real quick, because I was confused for a second. I was about to cop to saying the wrong name.
No, that's
but now I'm looking back over our sources, and yeah. It's definitely both are said.
Like many criminals, she added Anne and Alice to her name or referred to herself as that multiple
that
times.
That makes perfect sense. It's like an alias, so she can't get pinned down.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Just like sometimes I'll be Max Powers, astronaut with a secret, or Chris from Boston, who, again, is retired. We mentioned him on a previous episode.
People love Chris from Boston.
He just, you know, the brightest lights shine briefest. So here's to you, Chris.
That's sad.
It's good. It's okay. We've got to move on, you know. Circle of life and all that, as far as aliases and AKAs go. Alice's, or Anne's, criminal career began in 1912. Because she was caught stealing chocolate. In 1915, she was officially named the Queen of the 40 Thieves. The previous queen was someone named Mary Carr, also known as Polly Carr. But we don't know a ton of stuff about Mary. We mostly know, when it goes to who was the Queen of the 40 Thieves, we mostly know about Alice or Anne. And when you think about it, it sounds like a swashbuckling life, or it sounds like maybe a romanticized thing, but it was a brutal life. And they believed that the only alternative to this would be a crushing existence in poverty. You know what I mean?
Or possibly crushed under the thumb of some man.
Mm-hmm. And they did live it up. They were well known for
Big time parties, their soirees. That's right. They would really throw down at pubs and social clubs. And I think the fact that they also, because of their reputation, I would imagine they were allowed and permitted to do things that, you know, other women would not be, because people were scared of them and they didn't want to, like, raise up, right?
Yeah.
Because that wouldn't have been proper for a group of women to have a big old, you know, drunken to-do, right?
And that also gives them some support. That kind of lifestyle gives them some support in parts of the population, right? Because, you know, if the 40 thieves or the 40 elephants are coming to the restaurant or the club or something, that it's going to be a wild night.
Right.
I mean, you can party. You might get blackmailed later, but you could party.
That's right. I mean, they were getting the equivalent, the late 1800s equivalent of, like, bottle service, you know?
No,
they
yeah.
were, like, really, really dropping some cash.
And we do have to thank McDonald. We can't thank him enough, because Brian McDonald uncovered a lot of this previously unknown information by hitting the bricks, scouring official birth and death records, perusing marriage indexes, local newspaper reports, hunting down out-of-print books at the British Library to read contemporary accounts, and everything he found was verified. There's a thing where, like, imagine you grow up in a very impoverished situation, and you say, well, I can slave away at a minimum wage job until I get ill, at which point I have to be consigned to the poorhouse or workhouse or something, and probably die early of a disease that may well have been preventable. Or I can break social norms. I can not only become a criminal, but I can do it well. According to McDonald, they idolized glamorous movie stars and the decadent living of the 1920s flapper society. So they read about the scandalous, salacious behavior of people born into privilege or celebrity, and they wanted to emulate them. In a way, it is very similar to the stories we hear now about modern drug dealers.
That's right.
You know, I mean, Atlanta is full of strip clubs.
Yeah, they want the chains, they want the grills, they want all the stuff, the status symbols or whatever, but ultimately they're living a very risky and potentially short existence in order to have those things.
Did I ever tell you about that excellent Freakonomics report that broke down how much per hour drug dealers actually make on average?
You were saying it wasn't great.
No, it's the opposite.
Unless you're like the distributor or whatever.
Yeah.
The high-level individual that's really pulling the strings. That's where you know, make the big money.
Right. It's a very unfairly distributed hierarchy, typically. So if you want to learn more about that, and it's tangentially related to this episode, but it's fascinating information nonetheless, I'd like to recommend a TED Talk by the author Stephen Levitt, who presents the data he found on the finances of drug dealing. These folks are not living the high life. It is much more, what's the best way to say it? No, it's just terrible. There's not a good way to say it. It's a terrible, terrible life. Don't sell drugs. I mean, if you're looking to make a lot of money off of it, don't expect to.
Well, how about forming a very organized cell-based gang and doing smash and grabs for a living?
That would be, there's an interesting topic there too, Noel, because that would be much more difficult, at least here in the U.S. in the modern day, and definitely in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom, for a few years running now, has had the largest amount of closed-circuit television cameras, CCTV cameras, per capita, I believe, in the world. So you're much more likely to get caught on film, right? You're also much more easy to track if you have a cell phone, since we all have those GPS locators on our phones. It was easier to get away with crime back then.
Oh, absolutely. Right? I mean, like, it was just rampant. I can't imagine. Who would want to go into business? Have you seen the Ballad of Buster Scruggs yet?
Yeah, I've seen it several times. It
makes me think of the bank teller kind of situation where you're just constantly on the ready with, like, guns loaded mm-hmm. and pointed at every potential person that's going to walk in that door and rob you. I would just think that some of these shopkeepers must have been quite foolish for at least a minute, mm-hmm. you know, with to allow this kind of stuff to keep happening. I don't know. I wonder.
Well, and also, what can you do if you have a small shop? Are you supposed to continually employ 5 people just for security on the off chance that something happens one day? I mean, you're throwing money in a hole until the robbery happens.
That's right.
And you may be wondering, well, Ben, well, Noel, well, Casey, this sounds like quite an adventure and it would make for a great film, but you guys are doing a history show. Are the 40 elephants still around today?
No, they're not. And again, you don't even really hear much about them at all until this book came out. But in the mid-20s, there was a member of the gang named Marie Britton who kind of, on her own, through her actions in this kind of chain of events, led to the dissolution of this crime dynasty. I'm going to go so far as to call it that. 200 years?
Is that fair.
A dynasty? I think that's a dynasty. Mm-hmm. So, she had fallen for a dude who was not a part of this seedy underworld. And, you know, it's a network, and it's sort of like West Side Story, you know, where it's like the Jets and the Sharks or whatever. You fall in love with a shark, it's not okay with the Jets, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a little different. This person was neither a shark nor a Jet. This person was outside of the world entirely.
They were a square, a civilian.
Exactly.
Because Marie had fallen in love with someone outside of London's underworld, she had also broken one of the gang's many internal rules. Thou shalt not date a square. So she was called up to see Alice and Babyface Maggie. And Marie was scared. She brought along her father to protect her as her own muscle, essentially. And they, you know, we can speculate on the essence of their conversation. Alice and Maggie say, hey, you've got to drop this guy. He's lame. He's not in the...
He's not one of us.
He's not one of us. He's not in our crime sororities or affiliated crime fraternities. And Marie says, no, I'm not going to do it. At which point, Maggie whips out her aforementioned straight razor and attacks Marie's father.
Slice!
Yeah. And they escape. Marie and her father manage to escape, but Alice is not going to let this go.
Alice sounds like a real tough cookie.
Oh, yeah. She's not a Corleone.
Not for the better, necessarily. I mean, I guess if she's the kind of person you'd probably want in your corner, but if you make an enemy of her, she's going to come at you with a straight razor.
Right.
And she's going to come to your house and start hurling rocks through the windows and then force entry into the home and search manically for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm speaking of myself as though I were Marie and my father. And they're, you know, going to ransack the place. Mm-hmm. And in doing this, attract the attention of the police because yeah. It became a riot, basically.
Mm-hmm. Not Sting and the police.
No.
They weren't on the scene yet.
No.
So what happens?
Well, I mean, they slashed their way through this house looking for Marie and her father and ended up injuring some of the other folks that were around. And the cops came. The fuzz showed up because this is a whole melee, mm-hmm. you know. And the ringleader of the 40 elephants, Alice Diamonds, Diamond Alice, Annie Diamonds, Diamond Annie, was arrested.
Yeah.
And it didn't go well for her.
No, it didn't. They went to trial. They were easily convicted, Alice and Maggie, that is, because, you know—
This is Babyface Maggie.
Yeah, Babyface Maggie, because they clearly did this. But the prosecution, despite the fact that there were multiple members of the gang attacking Marie's house, the prosecution only convicted or only even charged Alice and Maggie because, you see, according to the rumors and the speculation, certain gentlemen in high places of society did not want the details of the blackmail activities to come to light. So maybe we can conjecture with a fair amount of certitude, maybe there were a couple of people in the government or high in business who said, look, you can convict the two ringleaders, but Greytooth Desdemona can't go to court.
That's right.
My wife can't find out.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, subsequently, there was a vacuum left behind because Annie, Diamond Annie, Diamond Alice, whatever you want to call her, the diamond, let's call her that, was put away and sentenced to hard labor for how many years?
Well, let's see. She was imprisoned in 1925, and the power vacuum has a pretty swift effect on the gang. By 1930, they're falling out of power, but people are still claiming membership of the gang, and they're still shoplifting up into the 1950s.
But it sure seems like Diamond Annie is the one who kind of had that iron-fisted control over the organization to the point where they existed almost as a central power in the London crime world. So when she went away, it kind of reverted back to this more petty thievery, and they sort of lost their grip on the underworld in general.
Right, right. And by the 1950s, the gang had just lost too much power. Maggie Hill ended up dying in 1949. Don't know where she was buried. But her best friend was Alice Diamond, obviously, and who's the, in Casino, is it Joe Pesci who's the wild card?
Oh, yeah.
His
oh,
character?
Yeah.
Okay. So Maggie Hill, by way of comparison, is kind of the Joe Pesci of this group.
Yeah.
And there's not really a Robert De Niro. If there is, it's Alice. But she, in court, attempted to attack members of the court during the trial.
Was it with a pen?
Who knows, man? Who knows? She was like a real-life cartoon Tasmanian devil.
Yeah. But I also read that she did not keep her composure when sentenced. That
she didn't.
She cried and freaked out and, like, yeah, but, like, got really upset, was not stoic at all, was very, like, emotional.
And railed against the court, yes. Probably because she saw more than a few people associated with their crime ring in court.
That's right.
On the other side.
With their pious wigs on.
Mm-hmm. We know that Alice Diamond passed away in a place called Southwark, close to the East Lane Market, in 1952. So this gang pretty much expired. Its death knell is the last imprisonment and then later the death of Diamond Alice or Diamond Anne. And that's not to say gangs don't continue in London today.
Oh, no, for sure. But it's, you know what the thing about London, too, is you always hear about how gangs there don't use, there's not as much gun violence because they're a lot harder to get.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to wonder if, like, the gang culture has kind of, like, been influenced by this more kind of crafty gang culture where it's more about, like, figuring stuff out and being sharp on your feet, you know what I mean, as opposed to just, like, running in and blasting up the place because you just don't hear about a lot of gun violence in London.
Not near as much as there is in the U.S. or some other countries. But knives, we have to keep in mind. One of my old instructors used to always try to hammer this into our heads that knives up close are more dangerous than guns.
Oh, for sure.
So they're probably walking around with some blades, a blade or two.
That's what I'm saying, though. To wield a knife, you got to be a little more brave and a little more clever and have a little more training, kind of. You know, you got to know where to, what to do with it.
Well said. Well said. And for the record, I agree.
So I guess I'm saying, way to go, London crime world, for being a little less lazy.
I don't know if I agree with that. Man, it's true, though. While gangs still exist and even thrive in some parts of London, there's not really, at this moment in time, something like the 40 Elephants, unless you want to say the banking cartels are gangs. But they rob people in a different way.
Very much so.
Do you like how I had to walk around the block to throw that little piece of shade in?
I loved it.
I'm telling you, man, the city of London itself, it's sketchy. The whole thing's sketchy. But that is the story of the 40 thieves, the 40 elephants.
Alice Diamond, Diamond Alice, Annie Diamonds.
Diamond Annie.
Diamond Annie. Yeah.
The all-female crime syndicate, or dynasty, which we think is appropriate here, who ran shoplifting and somehow got away with it for almost two centuries.
I want to see their like internal records, you know,
yeah,
for that 200 years. Like, I want to see the turnover of like who was in charge. If any of that was on paper, it probably wasn't. It was probably all just like oral history.
I wonder, yeah, because it's a huge liability to have something
for sure,
like that laying
for sure
around. But it's prestigious, and it would also really help out Marnie Dickens, who, as of 2017, was developing a series on the 40 Elephants or 40 Thieves for the BBC. And it has the potential to be a Peaky Blinders kind of thing. Did you ever see that show?
I started watching. I think I watched the first season, and I like it.
Yeah, I think I saw the first episode. And I started wondering whether I should also carry a razor around in my hat.
Yeah, our boss Connell really likes it a lot.
I could see that. That's classic Connell. Have you ever seen Peaky Blinders, Casey?
No, I don't think I've even heard of it.
Yeah, it's got Cillian Murphy in it. It's about a gang in Ireland, I want to say, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't it an Irish gang? Like, around the same time, in the early 20s. Don't know that they were around for 200 years, though.
So. No. Would you guys watch a show based on this crime syndicate?
Oh, yes.
I would, too. I'm wondering who they would cast. Let us know who you think would play an excellent Alice or Annie Diamond, and who is unhinged enough to be a babyface Maggie in your book.
You know who I could picture as being babyface Maggie?
Who's that?
Melissa McCarthy.
I like it.
She's got some acting chops, man.
She does
all these kind of goofy comedy movies.
Yeah.
But I think she's got the
range.
Goods. I think she's got it, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I'm gonna think about this and come back. It is the end of the episode, which means that if we are still carrying on this tradition, my friend, it is time for us to give a comic book recommendation or two.
Wow, we're gonna keep going with this, huh?
Well, we said we would. We'd give it a shot.
I like it. Have you read Saga?
Yes.
By Brian K. Vaughan. Mm-hmm. I've only read a little bit of it. And again, I'm not as much of a comic head as you are, but I have enough of an idea of what's out there to give a recommendation for a couple episodes. But yeah, check out Saga by Brian K. Vaughan. It's sort of a sci-fi, star-crossed space adventure. Is that a good way of referring to
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. It breaks a lot of genre rules. I think you'll really enjoy it.
He also wrote Why the Last Man, which I did read every moment of, about the last man on Earth after a disease kind of wipes out the male population and this one dude's still around. Everyone else is female. That's a good recommendation for this episode, actually.
Yeah. Actually mine.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, no. My bad. I only said it because it's the
Brian K. Vaughan.
Same
He's
writer.
A great writer.
And I believe that's being adapted into a big old series right now.
Right. Right. And for people who have yet to read it, this won't spoil anything. There is a character in Why the Last Man named Agent 355. And that comes from a real and mysterious part of early U.S. history. So if you want to learn more about the real life Agent 355, check out our other show, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know.
That was just recent, wasn't it?
Yeah. I don't want to ruin it, but check it out.
Do, please. And in the meantime, always, always want to thank Casey Pegram, our super producer. I don't know where we'd be without you. We would sound like fools, that's for sure. So thank you to Casey. Thank you to Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
Yes, and thank you to Christopher Hasiotis, our research associate for this episode. Thanks also to our other research associates, Eves and Gabe. Thank you, Noel, and thank you for listening, folks. I hope this inspires people, because I don't want us to get characterized as the inspiration behind a new gang of jewel thieves.
You know what? You do you, people out there. Whatever you think, be the change you want to see in the world.
So also let us know if you have found a story of another crime ring this successful, because regardless of your opinions about the internal workings or the consequences or their own strategies, there's no arguing with it. They were very, very successful. You can tell us about this on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. You can visit us on Facebook, where we'd love to introduce you to your fellow Ridiculous Historians on our community page, Ridiculous Historians.